What's up, Beardos? You're listening to episode 167 of The Bearded Vegans.
Basically, our whole philosophy boils down to don't be a jerk.
Don't be answering your question first by not answering your question. I really hope people didn't tune in to hear us talk about beards.
Welcome to the show. I'm Paul.
And I'm Andy.
And we are The Bearded Vegans, a podcast featuring a dissection of all things vegan.
If you're just tuning in for the first time, you can find all of our previous episodes at thebeardedvegans.com, and you can always reach us by emailing thebeardedvegans@gmail.com.
In today's episode, we're going to do some follow-up, go over the news, and conclude with an interview with James Spooner, a vegan tattoo artist, graphic artist, and director of the Afropunk documentary.
Paul, this interview is a little out of character for us, I think.
Because I did it?
No, I mean, I don't know. I feel like we had so much fun with our winter interview series. And one of my favorite ones was the one that you did with Mr. Hip. And I feel like for some reason that felt like it was just a fun interview more than anything. I think that maybe as part of us trying to find ways to make sure this podcast is sustainable for us is to start doing more things like that and just interviewing people that are just doing cool things, even if it's not necessarily some super timely topical issue that we really want to dissect, but just to talk to people that are really doing interesting things in the vegan world. So I feel like this interview falls into that category.
Yeah, definitely. And James is someone who has a man of many hats, Andy, who was also wearing a hat when we were recording, but like in so many different areas of expertise. And yeah, it was really cool to talk about all his projects and the stuff that he's working on, the stuff that he's doing. And I know I believe we've definitely gotten a few mailbag episodes about tattoos related to veganism, and you know, what better person to have on than a vegan tattoo artist to talk about these things. So we definitely, you know, dive into the topic of what it even means to be a vegan tattoo artist, what it means to get a vegan tattoo. So if this is something that you've never thought about, or something that you've thought about and like, I don't really know the ins and outs of it, well, this interview is for you then.
Perfect. I also cannot wait to hear it, Paul.
So, Andy, it looks like you do got something here that you want to talk about that you've been eating.
I'm going to rename this segment briefly to what we want to be eating. So, listener of the show, Mary, tagged me on this post from Heinz Ketchup. And, you know, listeners of the show know that I am I'm a ketchup boy through and through. And I think most recently talked about the ketchup slice from, I think that one is also from Heinz. No. That was just from a totally different company. They were trying to make ketchup slices, and I got it even though I knew it was gonna be gross, and it was. I backed it on Kickstarter. So I was tagged in this post from Heinz, and they're putting out ketchup caviar.
I'm not sure what that means.
So it looks like imagine like a boba tea ball, but ketchup flavored. But that's what it looks like. It's like ketchup that's been congealed into these little balls, and the only way to get them is to enter this like tweet contest. Like, you have to tweet a certain hashtag, and they've only made 150 jars of it. And I was like, man, I'd really like to try this horrible thing and like make a reaction video of eating it. But the podcast does not have a Twitter. My clothing line, Compashco, has a Twitter, but I notoriously like hate using Twitter. I haven't tweeted anything out on that, I'm going to say probably in 2 years. So anyone that's following my clothing line on Twitter is going to see this tweet about Heinz ketchup caviar.
And they're just going to be like, oh, his account has been hacked. That's what's happened.
So hopefully I win that. And if anyone else out there wins it and wants to send it to me to try, I will be forever grateful.
What are you supposed to do with it?
I don't know, because as many have pointed out, it'd be real hard to put it on like a French fry, you know, like you're balancing this little ball on a French fry or something, and they have pictures of it like scooped on top of like a burger, like a really fancy burger.
Interesting. But then do you just squish it and it like pops out like a fruit gusher anyways?
That's how I imagine it being like, but really I have no idea.
Is this like a joke? Are they like,
it's doing for Valentine's Day. So
they're doing a bit.
I guess they're just riffing. They're riffing on bits right now.
Oh, Heinz. They're bored over there.
Yeah.
They're like, we've had the catch-up game on lockdown since probably 1912, so we got to come up with ways to entertain ourselves.
Yeah, they really are nailing that catch-up game. They've perfected it. So anyway, thank you, Mary, for sending that in. Haven't really been eating all that much at all, really, just in general, due to life events lately. So, Paul, you been eating anything interesting?
You know, Andy, I'll say this. I went to Screamers in Brooklyn. They just opened up a second location. I don't know which location I went to. I think I went to the newer location, but I haven't had Screamers at their location in a while. Like, I've had it at Veg Fest and stuff. And in general, Andy, I just haven't had a pizza in a long time where I've been like, wow, I am blown away by this pizza. And let me tell you, this pizza, it really did it for me this time. It was a half buffalo, half pepperoni. And maybe it's just because I have not had pizza in a while, but I was like, oh man, this is what it feels like. I feel like I've been pizza jaded for a little bit, Andy. And like in my first time around college years, I feel like I ate pizza all the time, and maybe I just burnt myself out from it. And so I just haven't felt good about pizza in a while. And this one just made me feel real good. So
that reminds me that we accidentally entered into an Instagram pizza war, because I was visiting my sister and we did a homemade pizza, and I posted a picture of that. And then you pretty soon after posted your Screamers pizza, and it was pizza war to see which one would get more likes. And the Screamers pizza eviscerated my homemade pizza.
I felt bad about that, Andy, because it's like a homemade pizza is always going to be more meaningful than a pizza that's made for you anyways. Like if it's from your own blood and sweat and tears, it's going to be more important. So I almost felt a little bit bad about that. And plus it's like, you know, Andy, you are a phenomenal cook and a much better chef than I, but neither of us are professional chefs. So of course, like, the presentation is probably not going to be as good as a place that is literally doing this as their business. So,
well, I will say this pizza that we made, like, we bought the dough and everything else was basically from scratch, except for some sausage that we put on it. And then it was so good that we remade it like 2 nights later and used the Beyond Sausage hot Italian sausage, which is chef kiss, so good. And I caramelized some onions and roasted some shiitake, and we put some Kalamata olives on there and some fresh basil, and it was truly phenomenal.
That does sound good, except for those olives. Get those out of my pizza.
Man, you don't like pineapple or olives, and I feel like those two together are a great combo.
Well, I like pineapple in a vacuum. I like pineapple. I don't like olives in any context.
All right, well, moving on.
So it seems like we've got a little bit of follow-up today.
Yeah, we do. So last week was our review of Eating Animals, the documentary that was based off of the book by Jonathan Safran Foer. And I think it's safe to say our overall takeaway was this is not, at least my I'll say my takeaway was this is really more than anything pushing a love for small farmers and for humane meat more so than it was pushing anything related to veganism or not eating animals anymore. And one of the big discussion points was this idea that the book itself seemed to have made many people vegan. I knew a lot of people that went vegan because of the book, or at least vegetarian because of the book. And we were not getting that vibe from the movie itself. And I had posted on my personal Facebook page just asking people, have you seen the documentary and read the book? And does the messaging line up together? And one of the comments was friend of the show, Jamie Kay, who wrote, I led a talk back after a screening here without seeing it first. Loved the book, though, and was horrified along with everyone else that it was a glorification of happy meat, which was not like the book. I really enjoyed the book as a unique voice and perspective in my library of vegan books. Skip the doc, give the book a go. I'm not sure what caused the huge disconnect, to be honest. So I, you know, I sort of described this scenario in which a lot of people went vegan because of the book. And then you extrapolated that to say, well, if this movie is like the book, then maybe this movie could have a lot of people going vegan. But it seems like this is not the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know, Andy, we disagreed on quite a few issues when it came to reviewing that movie, which I think is good, but I was definitely a little more forgiving of it than you were, but I 100% see these points that are being made and I do see it how many people are like the main takeaway is the glorification of the local farms and humane meat and those sorts of things. So I totally get that critique.
Yeah. And so we also got an email from Christine, who sent us a clip of Natalie Portman on some morning show and sort of discussing this movie. So, Paul, I want to play this clip for you for a second, because we were like, Natalie Portman's this vegan, and why is she championing this film and narrating and producing this film? So let's go ahead and play that clip for everybody right now.
Because to Gail's point, you're saying there are farmers trying to do it kind of the old-fashioned way, so that meat eaters can eat responsible meat that isn't creating the toxic runoff and all of that.
It's actually quite a conservative argument. Like, the people who used to do it well, the real farmers, the American farmers, salt of the earth people, are not being supported. And it's a really corporate system that's pushing them out and creating a very inhumane way of creating our food. And it's also polluting. It's the number one contributor to pollution, more than cars. I mean, if you care about the environment, you should care about factory farming and, you know, changing farming practices.
So what is the alternative for meat?
Well, there's really great, first of all, I think it's unrealistic that people are going to completely change their lifestyle and eating habits.
So. We can cut down, though.
Exactly. I think being conscious once a day or once a week and just experimenting with what does it look like if one meal a day I don't eat meat. Mm-hmm. What is it one day a week? And then also, there are really great replacement things now. There's great replacement meats. There's the Impossible Burger. There's Beyond Meat.
Well then, Andy, I feel like it's interesting, one, that someone who was formerly vegan, possibly vegan, possibly not vegan at this point,
We got an email from someone saying that Natalie was still vegan. It's almost beside the point, except that I guess it is important to suss out the intentions of the producers and filmmakers involved.
But I feel like it's important, to me at least, it seems like it matters when she says something like, oh, it's completely unrealistic to expect someone to change their eating habits and their way of living. If she is someone that is literally doing, if she's an example of someone who did do that, why would she be saying, oh, this is ridiculous, I would never expect someone to be able to do this thing. But then, and then it's weird too that she goes on to say, oh, but there are these great meat replacements like the Impossible Burger. And so I don't know. I don't fully understand her point, I guess.
Yeah, and I will say, beyond the Impossible Beyond Burger comment, she does go on to say, you know, so there's great vegan cheeses and milks and things like that. But yeah, I think the thing that felt the worst about that clip was this: not everyone will go vegan, not everyone will change their lifestyle kind of thing. And of course, all the hosts like wholeheartedly agree, you know, and they're, you know, they do say, well, people can reduce. And it just seems like if you want to change the world, you have to act as if that is a possibility. And if all of your starting point is, well, not everyone's going to do this, so maybe one day a week, it just feels like you're setting the bar so low, and no one's gonna try to go beyond that bar if that's the bar that you're setting for them. But if you set the bar at vegan and then they go, well, maybe I could try out one or two days a week to start out, it just, I don't know, it feels very disappointing to hear this kind of rhetoric attached to the movie.
Yeah, it seems like maybe she's doing, and it's like, I also, you know, Andy, let me tell you this. I'm not a celebrity. I'm not a famous person. And I don't know the pressures.
Not yet.
I don't know the pressures of being a famous person. But she also might just be doing that thing where it's like, she might have her own strong opinions about these things. And if in fact, if she's, you know, if she's still vegan for ethical reasons, I'm sure she does have those strong feelings. But that type of thing where it's like, if you're a celebrity and you're in public, you might try, I can understand why someone in that position might like tone down their message so that it reaches a broader amount of people, so that more people will be like, oh yeah, Natalie Portman has a great point. And like, you know, I just feel like, I'm not saying that this is the right thing to do, but I'm just saying I understand why someone in that position might do that.
You're so understanding, Paul.
You know, just like put out a message that is going to be the most appealing to the most amount of people, like a safe message.
Yeah, and I totally get that. And I mean, Paul, we've never had like an interview on the show where either of us has to be confrontational about it. And mm-hmm. I think that I would totally crack under that pressure. And like, you know, we did our live episode with JL recently and we had slightly differing viewpoints and I'm like sweating and I'm like, oh God, no confrontation, you know, and obviously JL is like an amazing, wonderful person. And we weren't like arguing or fighting. It's like, we just have slightly different variations on this answer. And so I can only imagine what it's like to sort of go in front of a live audience or like live cameras like that and have to push a certain agenda. But it also feels like that was less someone being, you know, she wasn't like pressed on something. It was like that was like her starting talking point. Like she went out of her way to say that. So I don't know. It's just kind of a bummer. And to me, it's just sort of further clarification that the point of this documentary is not to aid in people going vegan. But if it is someone that has never thought about this issue ever, ever, ever before in their life, I'm sure it could hopefully open their eyes a little bit. But again, it just, as demonstrated by the first part of that clip, it really is just kind of this glorification of the small local farmer, because a lot of the language that she's using there is saying like the people that used to do it in the humane way and the way it was better back then kind of language. So I feel like all of this clip is basically just reinforcing that view of the film's messaging.
Do you know what that clip was from? Like what she was on?
The show was called CBS This Morning, which is just one of those morning variety shows, new shows.
Okay, because it actually wasn't going to surprise me if it was on like Fox News or a Fox program, but just because of the way she was saying things like, oh, it's actually, she was like, oh, it's actually a very conservative way to think about this and to live. So I was like, oh, she's trying to appeal to the conservative audience that she's talking to. Mm-hmm. That's what I figured, but I guess that is not the case.
Yeah, and now I've only seen the whole 5-minute clip. We'll link to this if people want to watch it, but nothing else in the conversation led to it being sort of tied back to any sort of conservative view. So I'm not sure.
Me neither, Andy.
Well, all right. Let's move on to this next little bit of follow-up. So back in episode 152, we did an episode that was called Can a Horse Sue Their Abuser? You remember this one, Paul?
I do remember it, but I don't remember that being the title. And the title sounds like the setup to a punchline.
Well, the punchline, it turns out, was no.
Oh.
That's what the judge ruled. Yeah, this was the case of Justice the Horse. And so the ruling came down that no, in fact, this horse cannot sue their abuser. But the Animal Legal Defense Fund, the ALDF, they actually contacted us to say, we'll let you know when we appeal, but we're definitely going to appeal. So they sent us that, and we're going to pass this information on to everybody else, because the saga of Justice the Horse is really fascinating. It could have some big implications for animal law in this country. So the title of the article is Animal Legal Defense Fund Appeals Dismissal of Groundbreaking Lawsuit for Abused Horse. You want to read this one?
Sure. So from ALDF.org, Washington County Circuit Court Judge John Knowles dismissed the lawsuit in September 2018, holding that a non-human animal lacks legal standing to sue on his or her own behalf. The Animal Legal Defense Fund will argue on appeal that as the victim of a crime whose legal rights were violated, justice does have standing to sue under Oregon law. If ultimately successful, this groundbreaking lawsuit would be the first to establish that animals have a legal right to sue their abusers in court.
Well, I don't know if I have much to say about this other than I wish them luck and I hope that this gets passed through.
Yeah, no, definitely. Definitely. So, and thank you for keeping us updated about it too. And I hope that you continue to keep us updated.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on into the news. Paul, we only have one thing to talk about this week.
Ugh, hated it, Andy.
I feel like we need some sort of, you know how we have the Dairy's Inevitable Downfall? I feel like we need some sort of segment that's like, aw, PETA is fucking up again or something like that.
Aw, PETA.
Aw, PETA. It's PETA. And then it's just PETA. Really? So anyone that thought we went too easy on PETA in that recent episode that was all about the anti-animal language meme, this segment is for you. So this tweet went out on January 16th, and Paul, the caption was, traditional, and traditional is in quotes, masculinity is dead. The secret to male sexual stamina is veggies. And you've seen this video, Paul.
Mm-hmm. Yes. What could only be described as just a bunch of dudes dancing around with large phallic shaped fruits hanging from their loins, I would say.
Yeah, it's like a banana and then some limes and then some to replace the testicles and then some like shredded lettuce for like the pubic hair. And it's all slow motion with some like sexy electronic music going mm-hmm. on. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I mean, Paul, there's so much to dissect in this ad. We'll put a link to the tweet if people want to watch it, but
Andy, I feel like the worst part about this ad is it's trying to fall under the guise of being the woke ad. You know, it's like, oh, like I just imagine PETA in their evil headquarters, their evil lair, being like, oh, what's the hip social justice issue that people are talking about nowadays? It's like, oh, like being against toxic masculinity. Yeah, okay, let's capitalize on that, but by doing the same, like, by, I don't know, it's just like they're saying that they're against it, but what they're doing in the ad is furthering it.
Yeah, so it's basically putting forth this idea that if you want to have better sexual stamina, you have to go vegan. And this is something we see. I've seen this in several documentaries. Even Forks Over Knives did this. It's talking about how erectile dysfunction is a result of blood flow. And if you eat fruits and veggies, you'll have better blood flow and stronger erections and all of those things, which, you know, I'm sure is certainly true for some people. But yeah, I mean, this ad sort of paints going vegan as this magic cure-all for any like sexual issue you might be having. But it's still like it's saying traditional masculinity is dead. But then, like you said, it's still upholding that sort of traditional masculinity, which is like praising, you know, or assigning value to larger penises and to sexual stamina and performance and all of those things, which are certainly very, I would say, strong components of toxic masculinity and traditional masculinity that is really harmful.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. It, like to the extent where I don't. Like I guess I get what they were trying to mean, but when they put, you know, traditional masculinity, I guess what they're trying to say is traditionally meat has been associated with masculinity, and that like that's what they're trying to get at. But to just try to tackle one issue of toxic masculinity by promoting a different issue of toxic masculinity, it just seems so like oblivious.
Well, it just feels like they're just like a sidestep. It's like a lateral move, and that they're just like, you can still place value on the quality of your erection and your manhood can be determined by how long you can have sex for and all of these things, just by eating plants and stuff, is that it just feels like a real lateral move in that regard.
I guess it's lateral, but it just seems to me it seems worse than lateral, because it's like you should know better than this. Like you should be doing better than this.
What I hate about it is that it's sort of pretending to be quote-unquote woke, but it's not at all, which is standard PETA. I mean, you see PETA like puts out shirts that say like feminist vegan and things of that nature. And you feel like that by putting out these ads, like, yeah, we're totally on board with feminism or something. Not that we're like the gatekeepers of feminism, but it just feels like they feel like they can co-opt certain social justice movements and pretend like they're on board with it without doing any research or having any insight into how harmful these types of ads could be towards the cause they think that they're helping to promote or the cause that they're co-opting.
Yeah. But again, it's like, I don't believe that they don't see what they're doing, you know? Like, I don't believe that this is a mistake, you know? It's like, oops, you're right. Like, we were just promoting something that's actually harmful and is a part of toxic masculinity. Like, I feel like they know exactly what they're doing, and they're just trying to, again, they're trying to appeal. I mean, I guess this is my celebrity Natalie Portman thing. It's like they're trying to appeal to the most amount of people possible by putting in this wokeness aspect where a lot of, like, they're going to try people with that, but then also this, like, manhood aspect of it to say, like, oh, don't worry, men out there, you can still be down with PETA too. So I feel like it's shitty. It's shitty to do that.
Yeah, I agree. And I think also the ad sort of makes the transphobic assumption that all men have penises as well, which is, of course, not the case. Mm-hmm. And so it reduces masculinity just down to someone's penis, which is obviously ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it sucks.
It's like this thing we see in veganism where I feel like it just in a lot, it, like in the way that, say, like fat phobia sort of manifests itself and people are like, oh, if you go vegan, you won't be fat and you're so scared of fat people and you won't become one or you'll lose the weight. It's sort of feeling like people have to leverage these existing negative connotations or preconceptions or whatever in society, but just from like a vegan angle. And you see it all the time when you see like slogans like real men eat plants and things like that. Or sort of promoting like, no, it's okay. You can still be like a really strong beefcake, hunky like man and be vegan at the same time. And just sort of this idea that it's like, yeah, I think it's important for us to be like, you can do whatever you want to do in life as a vegan. But when you're sort of appealing to certain things, it's like, why are these the people that you want to appeal to? Why is there this sort of lowest common denominator that we feel like we should appeal to these people and bring them into the movement as opposed to other folks that have less problematic views about these things?
That was very well put, Andy.
Thanks, Paul.
I don't know if I could say it any better than that.
All right. Well, I guess we can just leave it there and let us know what you think of this. If you've seen this tweet, again, we'll put a link to this and everything we've been talking about in our show notes, which you can find by going to thebeardvegans.com and follow the episode tab. All right, Paul.
Yes, Andy.
Let's move on into our interview. But before we do that, we just have to give a huge thank you to Catherine M., who recently upped their pledge on the Patreon. And people can help support the podcast by going to thebeardedvegans.com/beardo, which is spelled B-E-A-R-D-O, to support us either PayPal or Patreon, or just hit up the online store to help us out. And if you feel like you can't financially contribute, leaving reviews is always a great thing to do. And passing along episodes that you enjoyed to friends that you think might enjoy them as well, or perhaps benefit from the perspective being shared on them, also helps the podcast.
Well, let's get to this interview with James Spooner, and we'll talk to you after. All right, we're here with James Spooner, documentarian, tattooer, and soon-to-be graphic novelist. James, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. So the first thing that we always ask anyone that we interview is, what was your journey into veganism? What did that look like?
I became vegan when I was 16 in 1992. And I was like a very active part of... I was very active in the punk and hardcore scene. And kind of bordering between like crust punk and straight edge. And both of those things were, you know, at that time, very like veganism was a core politic in part of in those scenes. Mm-hmm. You know, so I was around a lot of kids who were vegan, and I was listening to these bands that were, you know, singing songs about vivisection and various parts of animal rights. And it, you know, it just started to make sense that if I was going to be a feminist, or if I'm going to be, you know, pro-gay or want to talk about civil rights, that I had to include animals in that conversation. So it took about like, it was like kind of a 6-month journey from like, you know, baby back ribs to like, but I just like, I was never even vegetarian. I just went from eating meat to being vegan.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And it's cool too, because I had a very similar journey in that it also, like, I started learning about veganism from the punk and hardcore scene, and it's nice that so many people have been positively affected in those ways, because I definitely know a fair amount of punk and hardcore kids who just, like, you know, couldn't care less about any sort of social justice thing. But it's good that there are people who, and there are people like making the music and putting out those messages, so that's good. That's awesome. So first let's talk about Afropunk. So can you tell us, just give us a brief overview, what is Afropunk?
Well, it kind of depends on who you talk to. Afropunk started as a documentary that I made in 2003, kind of talking about the journey of being a Black person involved in the punk and hardcore scene. That kind of quickly, after I started screening it, that evolved into kind of like a New York Black scene of like kids who were interested in art and rock and roll, and that kind of turned into a small DIY festival, which, after a number of years started to get like bigger corporate sponsorship. That's where I kind of like exited. Mm-hmm. And today it's like a multinational, I mean, it's in six countries. It's, jeez. You know, I mean, the big kind of like Black Coachella in six countries or something. Mm-hmm. Doesn't really have anything to do with punk or punk ethics or morals or anymore, sadly. But, there's a space for it, just in the way that there's a space for Coachella or anything else, you know? Mm-hmm.
Was the deviation away from punk and those sorts of ethics, was that kind of, if you don't mind me asking, what spurred you kind of departing from it?
Yeah, I mean, me and the guy who run it today, like, we were partners. Like, I was doing this kind of DIY film and screening it around on my own. And then I connected with him and we started doing concerts and stuff. And we just come from very different places, you know. So he's like a music manager. He's like, you know, he came into Afropunk with the hopes to getting one of his artists signed showing the mainstream that there is an audience for alternative Black music. Mm-hmm. And that was like, you know, I felt like was kind of parallel with what I was doing, but I was not interested in like mainstream anything.
Yeah.
But there, you know, as it started to grow, we started kind of butting heads a lot. And the conversations started to turn to like, well, if we like have, you know, if we had like white artists perform, then it would be, you know, we could get more people in the room, or if we, you know, and it was just like, well, that's not the point, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so eventually, once we were able to get it big enough where sponsors would be interested, it also meant like compromising on who would be performing and like what kind of messages we can send, you know? So mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely my ethics and morals were constantly being like questioned. And eventually I just was like, you know what, you guys can do your thing. Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. It doesn't even feel like something I'd want to be part of, even though it's my, you know, it's my baby.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, no, that totally makes sense. That makes sense. So let's actually talk about the documentary then. So what made you decide to make this? Had you made other documentaries before, or was this your first kind of experience with that?
Yeah, I didn't go to film school or anything. This is like straight up just like punk audacity.
Nice.
You know? So I was 21, 22, and I was having an identity crisis. You know, I'm a mixed race Black person, and you know, punk rock really raised me in a mm-hmm. lot of ways. Mm-hmm. Felt like, you know, I early on I adopted all of these politics, but the conversations around race were really limited to like, fuck Nazis, mm-hmm. you know. And as much as I'm down with like, you know, punching Nazis in the face, like that wasn't there wasn't an occasion to do that in my world. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. What was really happening was like, you know, privilege and stuff that like just wasn't coming up enough for me to feel comfortably able to embrace my identity. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I in effect needed like a riot girl for Black people. You know mm-hmm. what I'm saying? So when I was conceiving of the idea of doing this, I felt like, you know what, the punkest thing I could do is make a film critiquing the punk scene. So yeah, so I just like was like, how hard can it be? You know, I had a band record label at 17. Like, why can't I just like buy a computer and a camera and like start shooting people? You know,
I'll figure it out. Well, one thing that I noticed when I was watching the film was it's like, because something that when we are watching, Andy and myself, when we're watching vegan movies, one thing that we like to ask ourselves is we're trying to ask ourselves, like, who was this movie made for? And did the person that make this movie, did they have a specific audience in mind? Like, for instance, for vegan movies, usually it's either this is a movie for vegans or this is a movie for non-vegans to try to turn them vegan. And when I was watching this film, I had that in mind, just because now that I've watched so many of vegan movies, that's just how my brain thinks. And there were parts where I was like, I feel like this is to expose, you know, people with more privilege like myself, all the like white people, to kind of like kind of let you know what's going on. But then there were other parts where I was like, oh, I feel like this is for all the black kids in the hardcore scene to kind of know, like, there are so many of these different experiences and there are all these different kids having these unique experiences, and you're like giving a voice to those kids. So have you thought about that, like, when you were making it?
Yeah. I mean, I understood that, like, the audience would, there was going to be like kind of three, in my mind, there were going to be three kinds of people who would see this movie. There was either, like, you know, film and documentary buffs who just see, like, whatever, right? Mm-hmm. It's going to be like the punk and hardcore scene, regardless of race. Mm-hmm. And then there's going to be, and it's just going to be black people who are like, Afro punk, what the hell is that? Well, my name is in it, so I should check it out. Not Spooner, but my name Afro, you know what I'm saying? Like, mm-hmm. You know, and to my surprise and delight, it actually went well beyond that, because it turned out to be a metaphor for, like, marginalized people in white spaces, regardless, mm-hmm. you know. But I've had, you know, feedback where, you know, white members of the audience are, like, shocked, you know, and it's because it's, in a lot of ways, it's the first time they've heard what black people sound like talking to each other when white people aren't around.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, conversely, it's like, for a lot of black folks or a lot of people of color, it's very validating, because it became this thing where it's like, oh, I'm not alone. Like, this experience, like, it turns out that there's not just one black experience, despite what the media has told me, you mm-hmm. know, like, there is this other black experience, you know? And I think Afropunk, the film, in a lot of ways, has like crystallized that for people.
That's awesome. And so I noticed on the website for Afropunk, you're still doing a lot of film screenings, and you're doing Q&A sessions. And I'm just curious that, so this movie came out in 2003, so it's over a little bit over 15 years old. And has the reception to the film changed in the last decade and a half, or does it still kind of hold the same place that it did in 2003?
Well, first I should make the distinction that you're talking about the afropunkfilm.com, which yes. is my website for the film, because there's, like, absolutely zero mention of the film on Afropunk.com.
Oh, okay. Okay.
they've decided to, like, distance themselves from the message of the film, because it just puts them in more the way of more critiques, you know?
That's a bummer.
But I think, I mean, there wasn't like an official memo I got or anything. But,
yeah.
But, you know, yes, it came out 15 years ago. And in that time, you know, I did 300 screenings in 3 years. And then it kind of, like, it, you know, kind of petered off, as these things do. And then I really wasn't pushing it. Like, it was just kind of like something I did, you know? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, in the last couple of years, there's always, like, the festival comes around, and then articles, then or media comes out and says, like, you know, tries to interview me, and, you know, like, cause they want to find out about the roots, you know?
Yeah.
This summer, there were, like, all these scandals with the festival, and it really kind of, there was this, like, outcry of, like, what happened to the original Afropunk, you know? And I kind of just decided to, like, dust off the old movie and, like, hey, does anyone want to screen it again?
Yeah, you know? Yeah, yeah.
You know, and there's been a decent reception. So, you know, I'm doing 5 screenings in the Midwest starting tomorrow. Got, like, a couple, you know, there's a handful every month for the next, you know, going through the summer. So that's cool.
That's cool. And does it seem like when people are watching it now, does it seem like things have changed, or are things more or less the same in the punk and hardcore scene? I mean, that's like that's a big question. I mean, it's different everywhere. So
no, I think I can answer that question. I think that a few things have happened. So on one hand, in 2003, when the film was made, the idea of like black skaters was like unheard of.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You see a bunch of black kids riding skateboards in the hood, you know, in 1999, mm-hmm. like those kids were asking to get jumped, you know, but now it's kind of commonplace, you know? So I think there's been a shift in like certain attitudes that black people have towards like what they're allowed to do,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then I think that like the one thing that I really want to give props to the punk community for is that it seems like they actually listened to the critiques of Afropunk.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's the white kids in the scene, more likely it's like the black and brown kids in the scene, they've like started their own POC festivals, mm-hmm. you know? And there's like five or six in the United States alone in different parts of the country where they're decidedly black and brown fests,
mm-hmm.
you know? POC punk fests, you know what I'm saying? And like, that is really heartwarming to me.
Yeah.
You know, what, you know, in the grand scheme of things, like in the, you know, pulling out to the big picture, I don't think a whole lot has changed, you know, like look who our president is, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And if I could give like a quick little anecdote, when I was making the film in before I had even released it, I was at this like editing suite, kind of like putting the finishing touches on it. And I could feel this presence behind me. Somebody was like watching and listening, you mm-hmm. know? And I turned around and it was like civil rights icon, Kathleen Cleaver,
mm-hmm.
sitting there. And she's like, damn, are we still talking about this stuff? Yeah, no, not a lot has changed. I mean, a lot has changed and not a lot has changed. You know, it depends how tightly you want to focus on things. You
yeah,
know?
Yeah. No, I feel you. I feel you. So yeah, the last thing about Afropunk, where can people find it if they want to watch it?
I mean, the easiest thing is like on YouTube, or I uploaded it to a higher res version to like, what is that called? Wilia? I don't know. I can give you a link to
cool. Post. Yeah. We'll definitely put it up. I know I watched it on YouTube, but I didn't want to say that because I was like, oh, I don't know if he put that up there and I don't want
didn't, but it's okay. Like it's been, I find bootlegs to be a really, like big compliment, you know? So
that's a good way to think about it. So
the YouTube version has been seen, I don't know, 150,000 times or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, yes, I would love to get a dollar from each one of those people. But the truth of the matter is that probably 150,000 people wouldn't have watched it if it was a dollar, you know? So it's like, whatever, you know, I'll make my money in another one way or another.
There you go. All right, so let's transition into the vegan tattooing. So first of all, at what point did you decide to become a tattoo artist in general?
I've been tattooing like 9 years. So it was about a year and a half or 2 years after I moved to Los Angeles and kind of like, what's the next thing I'm going to do after this whole Afropunk thing? Mm-hmm. So I got an apprenticeship and I was kind of doing my little, you know, my half-baked apprenticeship learning how to tattoo, and about a year in, I met this woman who said that she was flying to Portland to get a tattoo because there's a vegan tattoo artist up there.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, you know, what? Like, what am I? Like, wait, what? You know, it was like clear instantly. Like, why am I not doing this? Like, at that point, I'd been vegan for like 18 years. Like, why am I not doing? You know?
Yeah.
So I like just went through all my stuff and was like, okay, this isn't vegan, you know, and you know, the guy in Portland, you know, kind of gave me some tips or whatever. And I started doing vegan tattoos in LA.
So what for someone that might not know, what is like a vegan tattoo and what could potentially be not vegan about a tattoo? And do you find yourself having to explain Like, do you find yourself having to explain this a lot to people who are like, wait a second, veganism is just about food? Like, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, the most common question is like, well, is it going to last the same? Like, as if I'm like tattooing with soy sauce or something. But like, okay, so in the beginning, ink was not necessarily vegan. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, there's animal-based glycerin and there's bone char in the blacks. That is not really an issue anymore. Like 90%, more than 90% of the inks that most tattooers use, mm-hmm, are vegan. There's only one or two brands that aren't.
That's good.
So that's not really so much an issue. So then people are like, well, what else is there? I mean, it's a needle and it's ink, you know? So the next thing in the process is stencil paper, right? Mm-hmm. So as of maybe 4 years ago, there became a vegan brand. There's only one brand that matters to anybody. It's called Spirit Paper, and they aren't even in the tattoo industry. Mm-hmm. They're kind of like a 3M type, you know, company, right? But they make this paper that tattooers use, and it was not vegan. It has gelatin in it. Mm-hmm. And it still is, but they made a vegan brand because my clients and a few other people like really kind of started a letter writing campaign, whatever. So now there is a brand, and I've actually heard, and I know this for sure, I can't verify this 100%, but I did hear that they are switching all of their stuff over to being vegan.
Ooh, that'd be cool.
Yeah, so they might have like, you know, thousands of reams of the old stuff that they got to get rid of, but that little letter writing campaign actually did something.
That's awesome.
Know? So that's really cool. Yeah. So the stencil paper could not be vegan. Then if you've ever had a tattoo or gone into a tattoo shop, there's like a very distinct smell. Mm-hmm. That's green soap. And there are brands of green soap that use animal-based glycerin. Mm-hmm. So, and you don't know it, which one is which, just by smelling it. You know what I'm saying? So
yeah.
I use Dr. Bronner's, no like promotion for them or anything, but that's just
the best 14-in-1 or 19, yeah. 19-in-1, 18-in-1, yeah. One of those things.
Yeah. And then, what else can there be? The razor that you use, you know, it could be Bic, it could be Gillette, it could, mm-hmm, have a gelatin strip on it, you know, like any of those things can happen. So, you know, that there's that to choose or think about, you know. And then, lastly, the aftercare and, mm-hmm, aftercare. The ointment. This is like a big one. This is like where you could get everything right and this will most likely be wrong. Is A&D ointment. And that's the ointment that they wipe on you during the tattoo. Mm-hmm. Like 98% of tattooers in the United States use A&D ointment, which has lanolin in it. So, you know, but there are alternatives that are like out in the market that weren't out in the market when I first started. Mm-hmm. So like, to this day, I'm still like mixing my own alternative because I just figured out a way to do it and it works, yeah, you know?
There you go.
And then there's aftercare. So there's like, that's a long story short, there's a lot of stuff,
yeah,
you know, but it's not what everybody thinks, which is just the ink, you know?
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're running Monocle Tattoo in Los Angeles, and it's like proudly, you know, boasted like 100% vegan tattoo shop.
Yeah.
Do you find that people are, I mean, I guess you kind of already said this, but do you find that people are skeptical of this, like in the similar way that people are like, oh, it's a vegan cupcake, so it's probably not as good, or it's like vegan, so it's not as good. Are people like, oh, it's a vegan tattoo, so it can't be as good as a real tattoo?
Yeah, I mean, that's happened. There's only been one time in all of these years where somebody's like, oh, I don't want a vegan tattoo. You
know? Yeah. Yeah.
That's all I kind of do. But I think for the most part, and granted, I'm in Los Angeles, I'm not in, like in Wisconsin or something, you know? You know, people are like, oh, what's a vegan tattoo? And I tell them, and they're like, oh, cool. You know? Yeah. Like, good date for the day, you know? Or, like, you know, it's like people are like, oh, I'm going to eat vegan today, you, mm-hmm, know, like, mm-hmm, whatever, like, just like a thing, right?
Yeah.
I went to the grill, and then I went and got a vegan tattoo. Like, go to In-N-Out, you know, whatever. So, yeah, that really doesn't come up. And at the end of the day, I think it's like my work speaks for itself, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's really what you should judge any tattooer by.
No, definitely. Did you like think about the branding at all? What, like, when you were deciding to put like 100% vegan tattoo shop? Because I know there are a lot of restaurants, you know, some restaurants will say vegan restaurant, some will say plant-based, some just won't say anything, but it will be a vegan restaurant. And I feel like there's so much that goes into that in terms of, they know they're going to attract or deter certain people. Did you think about that at all? Or were you like, nope, this is my thing. Boom, there it is.
I mean, you know, I guess there was probably a little bit of like capitalist marketing in there for me, because I did it when I was like 1 year in the game, and like everybody who starts out doesn't have clients, you know,
mm-hmm.
like trying to find people who will let you tattoo them is challenging, you know,
yeah.
especially work isn't like awesome because you've only just started. Right.
Yeah.
At that point, me providing a service that nobody else in the whole state was doing,
mm-hmm.
like, you know, instant clients, right? So yeah. The vegan community is very supportive of vegan stuff. So, and I'm like you say, just like very proudly promoting veganism through tattoos. So people are like, I'll give them a shot, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it allowed me to progress faster than if I didn't have that, because I had clients who were willing to like get down, you know?
That's awesome. That's good then. So was it a difficult transition then? Once you had that, you had kind of said you had that like aha moment. Were you just like, okay, boom, I got to do this now? Or was it like difficult to figure out? I know you have your mixture concoction for the ointment. Like, was it a difficult transition, or did you kind of fall pretty easily into it?
It took a couple of weeks. The only real issue I had was the one with the, ointment. I wasn't mm-hmm. sure what to do, because vegan Vaseline is super expensive, and like shop wouldn't pay for it. And you know, like I tried like aloe, and mm-hmm. that like was too like greasy. And you know, I just tried all these different things, and it took a while to like figure out the concoction that both worked and was affordable. Mm-hmm. You know,
that makes sense. And so, I don't know if I want to get the dirt from you. Do you, like when you see vegan tattooers that are not using vegan means, or you see someone that is vegan going to another tattooer who you're like, I know that vegan or that person is not using vegan products. Like, what, how do you feel about that?
Well, I don't fault people who like really love an artist and just get tattooed by them regardless of whether they're using vegan stuff or not.
Mm-hmm.
Because I understand that, like, I mean, this isn't necessarily a popular perspective as a vegan, but I get it. Like, I get like, yo, that artist does exactly the kind of work I want, and the vegan guy I know, like, I don't do traditional, you know, if somebody wanted me to do traditional, I would do a subpar job on it. So I understand them going to someone else.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I'm not as harsh about that as the former, where there's like, I do know vegan artists who even say that they do vegan tattoos and they're not doing vegan.
Oh,
tattoos,
man.
You know,
and
I don't think they're like lying. I just don't think that they put the work in to figure out everything.
Yeah.
And I'm vegan, you know,
yeah.
My ink's vegan, so it's a vegan tattoo. And I'm like, yeah, but you use, you know, lanolin, or you're using, you know,
mm-hmm.
but, or, you know, or they even, there's a vegan tattoo shop in, well, I don't want to, let me not call them out, but there's a vegan tattoo shop that when I did a guest spot there, they were using bacitracin as the ointment, which isn't A&D ointment, so it didn't have lanolin in it, but it is a petroleum product, and all petroleum jelly is filtered through bone char,
mm-hmm.
so not vegan, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, they're like, oh, you know what I'm saying? And they're like a shop that is promoting themselves as being vegan, you know? So it's really just like, how deep are you willing to dig, you know?
Yeah, Yeah, and I mean this conversation fits perfectly into a lot of the stuff that we're talking about on the program, because it's like we like to get into those gray areas, like the nitty gritty, where it's like, oh, yes, we're all vegan, but then there are these areas where like people disagree on or people do things slightly differently, like for instance, like palm oil or bone char, or those sorts of things, where some vegans still participate in these things and some vegans don't. So I feel like this is a perfect. It's good to have an expert on to talk about the tattoo stuff, because that's something that people have asked us about, and we're just kind of like, we have tattoos, but we don't really know that much about tattoos.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. And we, you know, I always tell people, like, look, we live in a toxic society. You know, like, I've been eating at a Mexican restaurant for 2 years that I just found out uses chicken stock in the rice, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm not beating myself up about it. You know, it's like, I asked 2 years ago, they said it was fine. Yeah. Like, you know? Again, because I went to a different location and I was like, oh, you know what I'm saying? So it's like, this has happened throughout my whole, I'm just, you know, I'm gonna beat myself up. Yeah. It's the world, you know.
Yeah.
And then on the flip side, like my girlfriend is vegan, and she still buys leather shoes, but she has this like funny philosophy where she like she'll buy leather shoes and then she donates $150 to a animal sanctuary. So she's like, the pair of shoes has to be at least worth it.
Yeah, like, yeah, you know. Yeah.
$500 pair of shoes, like, you know, like, is it worth it, you know? But it's like, you know, like, we all have our thing, you know?
Yes. So. Yeah. Yeah. We live in a very non-vegan world, and I feel like it is impossible for anyone to be 100% vegan unless you're like living in the woods and, you know, harvesting berries and stuff like that.
Yeah. And I'm just like, why, you know, like, why are we wasting our time berating, you know, my girlfriend for her like shoes when like, she's actually made the choice to be vegan, and most of her life is like spent promoting and protecting animals. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah,
like let it go. Go. There's bigger, you know,
bigger fish to fry, to use a non-vegan term. last thing about tattooing, do you feel like there is a shift, or are you pretty much like, it's me and a handful of other people and that's it? Or is there like a growing community for vegan tattooers?
Well, I think there's a shift in the products, in the companies making the products. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think there's a shift in the attitude of tattooers, but I think that like there are plenty of, like, for instance, I forgot to mention this, but the stencil applicator is like a lotion that they put on before they put on the paper.
Mm-hmm.
Like, one of the biggest companies, Stencil Stuff, like, it says vegan friendly right on the pack. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Is anyone that works there vegan? Probably not. I understand that, like, that's just one more thing going for them.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? So there are brands of inks that say vegan on their websites. There are like, there's a push against the A&D ointment because it's petroleum breaks down latex, and a lot of people still use latex gloves.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been these like non-petroleum products that are coming out and they say vegan on them, you know? So I do see changes in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
So the people who are buying them because they're good products or because they're vegan. That's, you know, yet to be seen.
Yeah. 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 So what tips do you have for people who are looking to get a vegan tattoo? Like, what questions should they be asking, or can people say, I guess, how much control do people have if they're going to someone to get a tattoo and they want it to be vegan? If they're going to any old tattoo artist, or would you say they should specifically seek out a vegan tattoo artist such as yourself?
I mean, it's always nice when people do the research, and there are now websites and directories and stuff where you can like, you can like do a Google search and find somebody in whatever state you're in, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I mean, it's really like how much guts do you have to be able to like talk to some like, you know, gruff old sailor looking dude, hey, use this ointment instead of that, you know? They might be like, yeah, whatever, or they might be like, no.
Yeah.
It's kind of, you know, and I've definitely had clients who, you know, have experiences in both, where they've called and been like, would you mind? And they're like, yeah, whatever, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because really for most tattooers, like, you can't tell me what machines to use. You can't tell me what needles to use. You can't tell me what ink to use. But, like, I don't care what kind of lotion I'm rubbing on you. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So if somebody wants to, like, make the effort to buy, like, all the vegan products to bring to their tattooer, you know, it might cost them, like, I don't know, it might cost them $50 or something. But it's doable.
Okay. That's cool. That's good advice. Thank you.
Yeah. You might actually turn that tattooer onto something. If you're like, you know, here, use this, this hustle butter. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the A&D ointment. They might be like, all right, sure. And they'll use it. And it's like, oh, this is rad. Can I keep it? You know, like, you know,
that's cool.
I've had guest artists use my ointment because when I have guest artists, I would ask them to, like, while you're doing tattoos here, can you just use all the vegan products?
Mm-hmm.
And they are like, can I take this with me? Cause this is it, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know,
that's awesome. Cool. Thank you. So the last thing I wanted to talk about was this graphic novel that you're writing. So you're currently in the process of writing this, correct?
Yeah. It's the script for it is written and I'm like 100 pages drawn in.
Mm-hmm.
Of just like line work.
Mm-hmm.
But it's at right now it's at 360 pages. Oof. So I've got another year or so minimum before it's even ready to like hand over to any, you know, publishing or whatever.
Yeah. So can you give us like the overview for this project?
Yeah, it's about my first year in punk in eighth grade.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really like about the discovery of like, of what punk rock is really about. You know, kind of going from being like a poser, fashion, you know, chaos, nihilistic punk to like finding like the true like DIY scene.
Mm-hmm.
While that is happening, it takes place in a small town in the high desert where I lived in eighth grade that is like super racist and there are Nazi skins and Nazi punks.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, there's also like a coming of age kind of racial identity thing that's going on in it as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I know you had mentioned when we were talking about the Afropunk documentary, you had mentioned something about like, yeah, you know, it's not always as obvious as, you know, going around punching Nazis. But let me ask you, will there be punching Nazis in this graphic novel? Unless you don't want to spoil it, which is okay too.
A spoiler. There is a racist who does get pounded, but there are also many instances of the Nazis pounding us. So,
yeah. So what kind of, like, because this definitely seems, you know, there are similar themes to this in the Afropunk documentary. What made you decide to do this now? Because the Afropunk documentary, you know, that was like 15 or so years ago, and then you've been doing the tattooing thing. So what kind of spurred the graphic novel?
Well, I've kind of wanted to get back into storytelling for a while, and I did have a reservation about making like another race-based punk thing.
Mm-hmm.
But memoir is easiest for me to write, you know, especially like on my first go. And I can't write a memoir that's not true to my experience, yeah. You know? So it's not, I don't think that this is basically like Afropunk the comic, mm-hmm. You know? Definitely is dealing with different things. And it's, you know, if it's more of a love letter to punk than it is a critique of it.
Okay.
But there's certainly crossover because both of them are based on my life, you know?
Yeah, no, definitely. Definitely. It seems like it's going to be really cool. And where can people, you know, where can they find out information about that? Where can they find out information about just you in general?
Well, I don't have a publisher lined up yet, but I do have an agent working on it. So, right now the best thing would be to follow me on Instagram at, it's at Spooners No Fun.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also, you can also, you know, periodically check out that website, spoonersnofun.com. And then my tattoos are Monocle Tattoo, and that's both monocletattoo.com and at Monocle Tattoo on Instagram.
Cool. And is there any other shout outs you want to give, any other like things you wanted to plug before we wrap it up?
I should say, like, thanks to my girlfriend for putting up with me. like, yo, my kid's gonna be playing the Beast in Beauty and the Beast, so check her out. I don't know. I mean,
it's okay if the answer is no.
You know, I think about who I know who are listening and be like, why didn't you say anything? Those are the only two people I answer to, so whatever.
All right, there you go. There you go. Well, James, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Yeah, thank you, man.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that interview with James Spooner. We'll put a link, all his links will be in the show notes. So where to follow him, where to follow the tattoo shop, where to find the documentary. So anything that we talked about in the interview, you can find those links in the show notes.
Very cool.
Yeah. So Andy, do you have any, speaking of cool things, do you have any cool things coming up?
Well, March 24th and 25th, I'll be at Vegan Street Fair in Los Angeles, California, and that should be a really fun time. It's always a big old huge event that I look forward to every year, and this year is expanding to 2 days, so maybe that'll translate into shorter lines and more food shoved in everyone's faces when they go there. And you can find a link to that event and all the events I'll be doing through the rest of the year. I have things confirmed all the way through July, I think, at this point, at compassionco.com.
Andy, when I just said like that great segue that I just made about cool things, that just reminded me that my friend Lynn texted me today and said, I wish that there was a blooper reel of all the funny segues that you and Andy say to transition between topics.
Well, that sounds like a job for an intern we're never going to have. Well, Paul, I thought that interview was really interesting, and it has me thinking about vegan tattoos. And Paul, you are someone that's quite covered in tattoos.
I suppose.
I mean, your back is probably 70% covered in tattoo.
Probably. Tattoo. Singular.
One tattoo. One giant tattoo. You got a lot of other tattoos. You don't like look like a super tattooed dude, but you got a lot of tattoos all over. And I feel like the longer this podcast goes, the greater the likelihood is that you will one day get a tattoo that simply says the following 7 words.
We are the Bearded Vegan, signing off. Do you know what that clip was from? Like what she was on?
It was some, you're gonna make me look it up, Paul. And it's all slow motion with some like sexy electronic music going mm-hmm. on. Mm-hmm. That's a phone call.
We are the Bearded Vegan, signing off. I've never thought about that before. All right, so we're talking to James Spooner today, documentarian, tattooist, and... No, tattooist? That's a weird... That's not a word. All right, I'm going to try that again. All right, here we go. One take.